Now we switch to the government side. NASA has had technology utilization efforts for about 10 years. Earlier efforts at Langley Field were effectively transferred to airfoil design for civilian aircraft. NASA's program has now greatly expanded, and NASA's Claire Farley is here to tell us about it.
I want to describe to you the NASA Technology Utilization Program, and I'd like to cite some of the things that it is doing today that I think may be of interest to you. We're reasonably specific about what it is we're trying to transfer, our own technology. We want to transfer it from aerospace use, which is fairly clear, but this is pretty broad, indefinite. And as a matter of fact, we consider that the entire external community, everybody else, if you will, out there, is a potential user of this technology. Government, medical institutions, public service agencies, big industry, little industry. We actually use the term technology transfer only when we are taking some technology that has been used in our aerospace business and using it in an entirely different context. To get this technology transfer done, there are three fundamental requirements, I think. First, you have to have a technology source, the transfer mechanisms of some sort. And finally, the users. Now, the users, as I said, they're out there in quantity. So our job really is to focus on how to do these first two things, of organize and have some technology that we've got something to transfer, and secondly, to figure out how to satisfy the man that must be satisfied, who is the user. Developing a source of technology, NASA operates what it calls a scientific and technical information office. And it does this not to do technology transfer, but it does this in support of its own major ongoing aerospace programs. This office collects reports on all the research that's done in NASA's 10 field centers and their laboratories. All our contractors submit reports on their work. They get reports from the other related federal government agencies, and it surveys technical literature published worldwide. And from this is compiled the kind of a database that Ron McGinley spoke of. And at present, it has 800,000 documents in it. And they're all indexed and abstracted and stored in a computer. And they're really readily retrievable on call. Of course, having this information is great, but it does no good unless people know it's there and use it. So we do provide biweekly a set of abstracts of everything new that's coming into the system. And we also publish periodically these little one-page flyers called tech briefs that describe those things which are new and which appear to be particularly useful to the non-aerospace user. I think probably most of you either routinely get or have seen these announcement journals that come out every other week and the tech briefs. If you haven't, give us a call and let us know, and we'll be glad to help you get them, because thousands of your associates are using them already. But to supplement this documentary database that I speak of, we also consider that the scientists and engineers in our field centers, the thousands of them, as well as our contractor employees, are a part of our technology source. And when we go to look up something in our database, we frequently find identified a number of people in the laboratories or in a contractor who have been working on that subject or are working on it right now. And their personal expertise is also available to be transferred. So as far as the technology source, we consider that we have both technical documents and personal professional knowledge as available. Now, when we move into the next area, the transfer mechanisms, this is where it gets tricky. The issue here is, how do you get into the hands and the minds of a specific user the specific items of information that he's interested in right now out of that technology base? And specifically, how do you do it without flooding him with a whole stack of reports, much of which may be irrelevant to his needs right now? Well, we've learned what a lot of other people have learned, The only real way you stand a chance of doing this is by getting people into the operation. People that can communicate with that user to find out exactly what it is he does want. And then the same person that has ascertained that has to be able to communicate with the technology source, both the documentary base and with the professionals on whom he's going to draw. Now, to do this, NASA has created a set of field teams. The purpose of a regional dissemination center is primarily to work with private industry, with the private sector, in helping them keep aware of new information in their field of interest and in helping them to solve problems where they have one. Each of these regional dissemination centers, University of Connecticut, Pittsburgh, University of Indiana, North Carolina Science and Technology Research Center, University of New Mexico, and here in Los Angeles, the Western Research Application Center with the University of California. These comprise the six regional dissemination centers that are operated by these universities under contract to NASA. As far as capabilities, each regional dissemination center has a small, full-time professional staff, interdisciplinary. But the big thing is they also have access to all the technical capability represented by their parent institution. That's one of the reasons they're located at universities. And in addition, they have access to the professional technicians and scientists, engineers at NASA's field centers. Well, this is a pretty substantial professional competence that is available at a regional dissemination center. In addition, the RDCs also have the computer tapes from the NASA database that I talked about. Now, recognizing that the NASA database doesn't always have the answer to problems, we've expanded the databases available at the RDCs, and they have the chem abstracts, the government research abstracts, engineering index, ASM, American Society of Metal files, and one or two other special files. When you put it all together, it's a pretty substantial set of both documentary and personal resources are available at an RDC. Now, when the RDC goes to work, it contacts a client, or perhaps a client, an industrial client, will come to the RDC, and the first thing is to find out what it is you're interested in. And if it is indeed they want to be aware of what's new in their field of interest, it's fairly simple. You define what is it you're interested in, and then every 2 weeks, the RDC will provide the client with a set of abstracts, new information in his field of interest. The client can scan this, decide what reports, if any, he wants to get from the list of abstracts, and he's in business. The fee for this, from $100 to $150 a year, depending on the scope of the field of interest, of course. In a lot of cases, of course, the industrial client is interested in more than a current awareness sort of thing. He wants a thorough search for some information, perhaps to solve a problem he's having in manufacturing. Information on a material, or on a process, or on an item of hardware. And in this case, the RDC staff uses not only its own capability, but the technical capability at its parent institution, technical capability at the NASA field centers, and in short, it tries to marshal the best resources it can, both documentary and professional, to solve that client's problem. Now, I've been using the term client here, and I've been doing so purposely. Because as far as an RDC is concerned, this industrial client is not only a customer to be served and who's paying for it, but they also guarantee to maintain the proprietary nature of whatever information the industrial client may choose to discuss with the RDC staff. I haven't mentioned yet COSMIC, the University of Georgia. COSMIC is sort of a special type of RDC. It operates under contract with NASA, and its function is to maintain and distribute those computer programs which have been developed for NASA and for the Department of Defense and which appear to have special utility for non-aerospace use. Right now, COSMIC, by the way, stands for Computer Software Management Information Center. But it has now about 1,000 computer programs, which we think, and lots of people who get them think, are useful for non-aerospace purposes. The average program sells for about $350. And there again, there's an index put out periodically of what's available. If you're interested, well, you can write directly to Cosmic or give us a phone call, and we'll be glad to get you on the mailing list. Now, we have about decided that the RDCs and Cosmic together comprise a fairly successful transfer mechanism. Now, how do we know? Or how do you judge success? Especially when a lot of the clients tell us very frankly that they just as soon not discuss what they're doing with the information or assistance they're getting from an RDC. In fact, they just as soon not even tell us whether we're doing any good or not, but they keep coming back and paying their money. So I guess the only real way we've got to judge success in the gross sense is that in a pay-for-service business like this, if the number of customers keeps growing, you're probably selling something pretty good. Because the value of these things have been in operation long enough that the value of the product should be fairly well known by now. So this gives us some assurance that it's a worthwhile product. We do also get frequent letters from people saying, I've been using your place and it's great. Don't close it up. Never mind what I'm doing. Just keep operating. On the other hand, some companies have chosen to announce what they're getting out of the RDCs. Ford announced just recently that they saved $12 million a year on a computer program they got from Cosmic. The little smaller companies use the RDCs extensively. The WESRAC, the RDC here at the University of Southern Cal, has been cited by California companies, as small companies such as McCulloch Electronics for their high energy battery developed. Conquip for their fluid logic control system. Spectromagnetics for work that they were underway. In fact, they hope to double some of their business based in part on assistance they got from the RDC. And Dr. Semenov from ALR Research Associates told us that the information I got from you guys was worth $100,000. And when you went to the moon, you didn't really bring back moon rocks. You brought back medical know-how. Well, instances such as these, again, give us some assurance that while the RDCs may not be the ultimate transfer mechanism for the private sector, they are performing a useful service. Now, just as the RDCs work in the private sector, we have another transfer of teams that work in the public sector. And these are our 7 application teams. Each of them is operated under contract to NASA and performs in the public sector a problem-solving type of activity similar to that performed by the RDC for the private sector. The biomedical application teams. There's one at Research Triangle Institute, Southwest Research Institute, and Stanford University Medical School. We have 3 biomedical teams because half of the clients almost are over 75 individual hospitals and federal and state health agencies are working with our biomedical application teams. The remaining 4 teams, all at not-for-profit research institutes, except the one at Apt Associates up here in Cambridge, but the one at Research Triangle, at ETRI, and at SRI, cover the other disciplinary areas. In operation, the staff that an application team has is not entirely unlike that of an RDC. They have a fairly small interdisciplinary professional staff, perhaps of 5 people or so. Again, they use the entire technical expertise of their parent institution. And the application teams have a close and a continuing interaction with our NASA field centers on specific problems that they're working with. Now, it's not uncommon for an application team to identify what appears to be a really great technical solution to the problem that perhaps an EPA may have in solid waste disposal, or that a hospital may have in healthcare. And then the user will say, you know, that looks just great, but where do I get one of these things? Or how can we fix it so that it'll work just a little bit better, because the way the technology that you guys used in the space program, is what I need, but it's got to be switched around a little bit. And in selected cases of this type, why, NASA goes ahead and funds this adaptation or this modification of the basic technology to let it really meet the user's requirements. We call these projects applications engineering projects. We have about 100 of them underway right now. Many of them are being done by contract with industry out of our field centers. Others are being done by the field center people themselves, and others are being done by the application teams. And the typical result of an applications engineering project is you provide the user with a piece of hardware that answers his problem according to his specifications in his environment and confirmed in a test conducted either by him or according to his instructions. To illustrate this, in the medical field, we're awarding a contract now for a drug detector that'll identify heroin in the urine of a patient. This is of great interest to some big cities, New York, Detroit, or New York, Philadelphia, so forth, as well as to the Department of Defense. Another medical project being installed right now for test this fall in a hospital in Alabama is a device to assist patients that are either quadriplegic or severely handicapped. If the patient can wiggle his head from side to side or even blow his breath with a bit of force, he can activate a switch that will let him turn on his lights in his room, turn them off, turn on the television, change channels, turn the pages of a book, raise his bed, lower his bed, call the nurse, whatever you want. I don't know that they've quite reached it yet in this first one, but we even expect to be able to hook up a telephone with him. The Bell system has said they'd be glad to help us do that so that the guy can call home while he's lying in the hospital. This, of course, is great interest. Department of Defense, Veterans Administration, rehabilitation hospitals, to cut down the nursing care so that they don't have to have somebody continually with this patient, but at the same time they can have confidence that if he needs help, he can get it just by flipping his head to the side and calling the nurse. In the environmental area, for $6,000, we have a project underway to put a flow meter in a sewer pipe in Dallas, Texas. Another environmental project, recommended, by the way, by the EPA, because we don't pretend to be authorities in the environment. The things that we're undertaking are the things that environmentalists say they want solved. And EPA has recommended, for instance, that we go ahead and award a contract for a solid waste segregation and disposal program. For the Bureau of Mines, we're developing a methane detector for use in coal mines. In housing, flat conductor cable technology has been used and is being used. It's hardly a brand new technology, I know. But now on the market, commercially available, is a low voltage switching circuit from the overhead light fixture down to the wall switch. And this can be surface mounted. It only has 2 volts. And it can save money in original construction as well as for modification of housing. And we're doing further work now toward adapting the same use for the power circuits in-house. Fire safety, I guess the most important project underway here, is the fireman's life support system, which happens to be the number one problem identified by the 80 cities that we do business with in one group through a contract we have with Public Technology Incorporated, which acts as an interface with all the cities and tries to aggregate and prioritize the problems that cities have for which they like technology, to which they like technology to be applied. Now, this is a rather diverse group of activities that we have underway here. In selecting which projects we fund, we try to make sure that it's a significant problem. That is, it's one that's been cited as something that really needs to be done by a responsible public sector organization, such as EPA or a medical institution. Try to make sure that the solution to this problem will have a broad impact and not just satisfy the whim of some researcher in some particular institution. We try to make sure that we don't get involved in researchy type projects, but that we focus on using existing technology and adapting that And lastly, we try to produce a piece of hardware, a process, or a technique that can be used by practicing people in a given public service area. We've only been in this technology applications or applications engineering thing for about a year. And as the results are starting to come in now, well, we're finding that the real question switches from technical development to who's going to fabricate and sell this thing. If this fireman's life support system is the greatest thing since white bread, how are the fire departments going to get it? And who's going to make that patient assist thing if it proves out to be a whopping success in that Alabama hospital? Well, obviously the answer has to be private industry. You can keep the public sector and the private sector apart, as we sort of have to when we start providing funds for projects. But if the public sector needs are ever going to be met, the private sector has to get involved, and the earlier the better. And you'll notice when I was talking about some of the things that projects we have underway, many of them are being done by contract, competitive, with private industry. And we hope that their interface with the user in determining requirements through user design committees to make sure everybody knows what we're building here, will provide enough of an incentive for them after the development program to go ahead and fabricate and market. In other cases where we're doing the development in-house or with one of our application teams, we're going to use the regional dissemination centers and their contacts with industry to make known what products are being developed, what's the status of them, and inquire from their own clients as to whether or not they're interested in a potential new product opportunity. And we hope by this sort of an interaction of public and private sector, get the public sector requirements met and provide new product opportunities for private industry.
Our final speaker in this issue of Soundings comes from the National Science Foundation. Dr. Frank Herzman is responsible at NSF for getting the state and municipal governments on board for the application of science and technology. These projects also involve private industry and the universities. Let's hear the NSF side and Dr. Herzman's own views.
In the last several years, there's been a considerable change in federal R&D priorities to emphasize R&D in the civil sector. For example, just since 1969, there's been a 65% increase in the investments in R&D in civil sector programs, with an increase from $3.3 billion to $5.4 billion in 1973. To some extent, this has been at the expense of the space effort, which has suffered a decline in expenditures from 1969 from $3.8 billion to, in 1973, $3.0 billion. Over the last 10 years, the increase in investments in civilian areas of R&D has been from just slightly in excess of $2 billion to the 1973 level of $5.4 billion. In bringing about this increase, I believe that state and local governments have been to a large extent left out of the picture. The implications of this, I think, are fairly sizable for those people in R&D management positions in the federal agencies. Through the federal grant and aid program of assistance to state and local governments, we're investing right now approximately $40 billion through some 1,400 separate grant and aid programs for the benefit of state and local governments. These are operational programs and not R&D programs. In addition to the federal subsidies to state and local government, these governments themselves at the state and local level spend in excess of $150 billion currently. When one looks at the overall government investments in R&D, state and local governments themselves are not large investors in R&D. For example, in 1967, the only year that we have comparable data for, while the federal government was spending in excess of $16 billion in R&D, state government was expending only $136 million, and local government only $31 million in R&D. Moreover, half of all state and local government expenditures in R&D were subsidized by the federal government. You can see, therefore, that we have a picture where state and local governments are the dominant elements in government in the United States, responsible for the solution of domestic problems, that they control most of the operational money, yet the R&D system itself is largely dominated by federal government. This places a large responsibility on those people that are in charge of operating the federal government's R&D system to maintain effective programs of technology transfer and technology utilization for the lower levels of government. The model for most of the technology utilization programs of the federal government today is the Agricultural Extension Service. Of course, agriculture has had a considerable history behind it. It stretches back to 1862 with the passage of the Land Grant College Act. It remained until 1914, when the country adopted the county agent system with the widespread emphasis that it placed on enhancing technology utilization. The results of the adoption of this particular program are, of course, well known, and it's made this country the strongest agricultural country in the world today. Unfortunately, however, no other federal agencies have such explicit policies and mechanisms for promoting technology transfer or utilization written into their enabling legislations. A few, however, have general mandates to perform transfer functions, but usually these fall short of the utilization stage. A committee has been established under the President's Science Advisor and the Vice President, called the State and Local Government Technology Sharing Committee, which is now in the process of reviewing every federal agency R&D program to see that there are adequate dissemination and diffusion systems built into those programs so that the R&D reaches the intended user. Basically, today, existing federal agency technology utilization programs can be categorized into four groups: clearinghouse functions, communication programs, training programs, and change agent programs. These vary from very passive modes of technology utilization or transfer to very active modes, such as the change agents. Examples of the clearinghouse activity are the National Technical Information Service in the U.S. Department of Commerce, the Smithsonian Science Information Exchange, the ERIC system of the Office of Education, and so forth. Communications programs, the various agencies include the brief program of the HEW. BRIEF being an acronym for Bring Research into Effective Focus, which is a one-page or two-page roundup of completed research activity of HEW, the Small Business Administration technology briefs, and so forth. Other agencies have more active programs in the training area, which include conference workshops, course, and manuals. Among these agencies are AEC, HUD, and EPA, which has a new program underway to prepare manuals in such areas as municipal wastewater treatment which are primarily intended for the edification of private consultants. The most active approach to technology utilization is the Department of Agriculture use of change agents. Other agencies which have sought to emulate the Department of Agriculture in this area have not been terribly successful. One was the ill-fated State Technical Services Act of the U.S. Department of Commerce, which when President Johnson signed the legislation in 1965, he hailed as laying the groundwork for a revolution in American industry. Of course, this did not come about, and the program was killed 2 years ago by direct congressional action, but with the implicit consent of the administration. In addition to these four modes of technology utilization, there's coming into being a fifth, which is the personnel mobility provided for under the Intergovernmental Personnel Exchange. To date, however, only 243 assignments have been made under the Act, and few of these could be classified as directly related to technology utilization objectives. I'd like now to turn to the subject of technology utilization in the National Science Foundation. When NSF was first created in 1952, of course, its total mission was concerned with promotion of basic research strength throughout the United States. In 1968, the mission of the NSF was changed to include the support of applied research activity. This was a very general statement of authority. It did not include limitations with respect to the field or subject matter in which it would be exercised. And indeed, the only limitation was that unless there was a special directive from the president, that NSF could not support applied research activity in industrial or profit-making firms. This expanded authority, coupled with experience the foundation had previously gained in operating problem-oriented research activity in such programs as our Antarctic program, has led the foundation to engage more directly in focusing research on selected environmental and social problems and on the potential impacts of future technological developments. The principal program under which this problem-focused research is conducted is called RAN, which stands for Research Applied to National Needs. The emphasis on societal problems gives RAN a strong user orientation, which is an essential element for a successful technology transfer and technology utilization program. It gets into such research areas as looking at the better collection of social data, looking into opportunities for improving the organization of communities, weather modification, environmental aspects of trace contaminants, earthquake engineering, excavation technology, etc. Early in the design of the RAN programs, it was recognized that we needed a very strong research utilization function and that this should be a shared responsibility of a central unit and the individual programs that were responsible for support of the R&D activity. The separate unit which was created was the office for which I'm responsible, which is called the Office of Intergovernmental Science and Research Utilization. The research utilization functions of the Intergovernmental Office are briefly to represent user needs and requirements, to strengthen present and develop new linkages between the research community and user groups, and these activities are not limited to program concerns of the RAN operation, or indeed to the National Science Foundation. What we attempt to do through the Intergovernmental Science Programs is to look at the potentials for placing state and local governments in a better position to relate to the developing research and technologies of the scientific and technical community, and enter into more effective partnership arrangements with other federal agencies. The program we have now operational in the city of Tacoma, Washington, which we classify under our management model, organizational management model. Here we've attempted to build a strong organizational management capability in the city to direct science and technology into operations of benefit to the city. Perhaps today it might be fairly said that the city of Tacoma, Washington is becoming the leading center in the United States for undertaking fire research activity of benefit to local governments. They're not doing this alone, however, because we've provided them with funds which they can make the choice to draw in other research performers that will be of use to them in developing their programs. They principally allied themselves with the Boeing Company and the Tacoma Boat Company in the industrial sector and the University of Washington in the academic sector. The reason for the Tacoma Boat Company is that they're working on an advanced design of a new firefighting boat, which I think will revolutionize the way that peer fires in the United States are fought by fire companies. Specifications for the science and technology which will be transferred to the city come from the city itself. There then ensues a process by which the firms negotiate out suitable projects that they can work on, which draw on the technical skills that that exist within the companies. There are very few examples, however, of this kind of approach that exists in local governments and throughout the United States. Indeed, it could be said that there are less than 10 examples of this kind of project activity that exist in local government. The more normal model, the voluntary advisory group, which is set up to advise the local government, or in some cases state governments, on problems that they may face, and it attempts to skim the skills of the scientific and technical community in providing either solutions or new directions that will be a benefit to the city. In the city of Philadelphia, for example, they're engaged in work on energy and water management and waste management, and they've set up panels to assist the city, which comprise the leading 100 scientific and technical people that exist in the environs of the city of Philadelphia, from industry, academia, and the large nonprofit groups that exist in that city. With the legislature in California, we've established a Assembly Science and Technology Committee, which is modeled after the President's Science Advisory Committee. It's headed up by Emil Morak of the University of California, Davis campus. And it too, has established technical panels which have looked into a number of issues of importance to the people in California: electrical energy requirements of the state, radiation safety, solid waste management, healthcare, population policy, and the very real problem of unemployed aerospace people. We supported projects with a number of the universities and paired them with particular cities. We've also experimented with a little larger scale program at Penn State University, where we've funded public extension agents that will operate in connection with all the municipal governments in the state of Pennsylvania. We have five of these people that are employed full-time to help the municipal governments in Pennsylvania on the full spectrum of problems that they may encounter. It's run in parallel with the PNTAP activity, which is a program to provide technical assistance to small industry in the state, and indeed it draws sustenance from that larger scale program. At the state level, we've experimented with mechanisms like providing a Council of Economic Advisors to the state of Minnesota and the establishment of an academic research council, which helps the state of Iowa in formulating the overall state budget and operation of state programs. Other activities of the foundation, the Experimental R&D Incentives Program, which is intended to, through carefully controlled experiments, to find out what incentives will increase non-federal investments and participation in R&D and can better encourage applications which improve economic growth and productivity or lead to the solution of societal problems. That program is funded at its first year level at $18 million of dollars, with $12 million for private sector activities and $6 million for public sector activities. We also have the National R&D Assessment Programs, which will assess how science and technology contribute to development of national goals and objectives, and to the quality of life, job creation, economic growth, and so forth. I think that the R&D community should recognize this change in direction, and that the new federal approaches are increasingly going to favor those who act as science brokers, in other words, those who put existing knowledge to work. This does not mean that federal investments in basic and applied research will be slowed up, but instead it recognized the principal functions that the principal importance of activities in the utilization area.
We sincerely thank our speakers for permitting the editing needed to fit Sounding's strict time limitations. Regular Sounding's listeners will recall that since its beginning, Soundings has emphasized the transfer of technology to the civic sector through such topics as the environment, its engineering challenges, and engineering in the health industry. If you would like to hear more or different topics along this same theme, please write me, Walt Beam, your Soundings editor, at Post Office Box 172, Chappaqua, that's Chappaqua, New York, 10514. And so until the next issue of Soundings, thanks for listening. IEEE Soundings is a registered service mark of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York.